Hey guys, I'm Jen, owner of Hello June Creative, a boutique brand and web design studio. I'm here to help you learn, up-level, and find community in your design business journey. Just remember, the only designer you need to be better than is the one you were yesterday. Hey guys, welcome back to the podcast. I just had an amazing conversation with Emmanuel Probst from Ipsos, a global market research company. I'm going to go ahead and read his bio and then we'll dive right into the conversation. Emmanuel Probst is Global Lead Brand Thought Leadership at Ipsos, a global market research company, adjunct professor teaching consumer market research at UCLA, and a Wall Street Journal and USA Today bestselling author of Brand Hacks and Assemblage, The Art and Science of Brand Transformation. Emmanuel's background combines over 17 years of market research and marketing experience with strong academic achievements. At Ipsos, he supports numerous Fortune 100 companies by providing them with a full understanding of their customer's journey. His clients span across a wide range of industries, including consumer packaged goods, retail, financial services, advertising agencies, and media outlets. He holds an MBA in marketing from the University of Hull, United Kingdom, and a doctorate in consumer psychology from the University of Nottingham Trent, United Kingdom. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Emmanuel. Hi, Emmanuel. Welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for sharing your valuable time with us today.
Jen, thank you so much for having me on the show. And thank you for this opportunity to connect with you and your community today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. So in my intro, I mentioned your new book, Assemblage, The Art and Science of Brand Transformation. And I'm just going to start off by recommending the book to anyone listening. I know, you know, we were just talking about how market research seems like this big, scary term, particularly for smaller boutique studios like ours. And just the insights, the data, the practical tips, the way that at the end of every chapter, you kind of broke everything down into these really memorable bite-sized pieces. I feel like this book is going to be in my library of, you know, brand and brand strategy and design books that I can just go back to and look at when I'm starting a project or when I'm diving into someone's audience. So just wanted to give you that compliment and recommend the book. And we'll share at the end of the episode how you guys can go and find that.
Excellent. And I think we can start with an uplifting note to tell our listeners that you don't need to be big. You don't, of course, I work at Ipsos. Ipsos is a large market research agency. But as outlined in the book, it is not the brand with the biggest budget that wins. It's about the quality of the idea, being smart about things. And there's so much you can do as a small studio or as an independent studio. You don't necessarily need hundreds of millions of dollars to succeed.
I love that so much. And I feel like that kind of leads us into our first and second question here. Before we get into our listener questions, which thank you guys so much for submitting questions for Emmanuel all around market research, I would love to hear your definition as, you know, a veteran of the market research and marketing spaces over 17 years in those spaces. How do you define market research as it pertains to building a brand that's going to succeed?
Market research is evidence-based decision-making. It's about providing you with information, and that can be qualitative, quantitative, social media listening, ethnographies, keywords, what have you, but it's providing you with evidence to support your decision making. And to be clear, market research is about mitigating risks often, and it's about giving you some directions on what to do next. It is not a guarantee to succeed, or else, Jen, I would be on an oversized boat in the Caribbean right now, sipping champagne and smoking Cuban cigars. But in all seriousness, the work we do in our clients is to inform, is to explore, is to discover, is to understand the audience. And then it is to confirm, it is to validate, it is to quantify, it is to clarify what the brand needs to do next. That is what market research is about. And this thinking, this definition, if you will, this principle, it applies just as well to Nike as it does to a independent freelancer working from home or from Starbucks.
I love that. And I feel like a lot of the people listening right now might not feel like market research is something that they're allowed to do, or that is accessible to them, or that might be valuable to their clientele. A lot of the decision making that I do as a designer feels very intuitive, and I've learned to trust that intuition over time as I've seen my clients succeed. But there is something so valuable, like you were talking about basing your design or strategy or copywriting decisions on real data and proven results. So it's kind of, you know, the art and science, it is a meeting of art and science, which I think is something that's so interesting and exciting to get into. So love that definition. Moving on to our first question. One of the things that I loved most about reading Assemblage was just the overwhelming but interesting amount of data and statistics. The things that I remember particularly in one of the later chapters around consumers' mindsets about sustainability, customers feeling like recycling is one of the most impactful ways that a brand can help the environment. And so even though jet fuel, transportation, mm-hmm. some of those larger things are actually more impactful, brands have taken that knowledge and that research and invested heavily into not only creating sustainable packaging, but creating marketing campaigns around the fact that they have sustainable and recycled packaging. So our listener, Andrea Vedic, wants to know, how does Ipsos typically collect its data? She says she knows the food industry uses Nielsen. Is it hard to get access to this type of information? And then once you have it, how do you take the data you find and create an action plan for your clientele?
Yeah. So many things to reflect on, to unpack. First, Jen, you said that market research often feels unapproachable. And that's because we like to make it complicated with advanced analytics. I think the smart move is to simplify and clarify things for people. It's easy to be condescending and to show off with acronyms and complex analytics. That is not, in my opinion, what is valuable to our clients and to our audience in general. The real talent, if you will, is to transform this complexity into something that is clear and simple for the audience. Next, about our listener's question. Well, truth been told, a firm like Ipsos, we do large-scale data collection. You mentioned Nielsen. Those firms have access to extensive data sets and what we call fieldwork capabilities to collect dozens of thousands of surveys. And this data can be expensive to collect and not always readily available, not easily to digest, to access, to analyze for the smaller studios. Now, here's the good news. Again, for you to convince your clients, it is not about showing off with hundreds of thousands of data points. It is to bring them an insight that is intriguing, that is a little bit quirky, a little bit different. And you spoke earlier, Jen, about following your intuition, which I think is really important because that's where creativity is at. And that's where the large agencies suffer because their people might have a vision and some great intuitions, yet they get vetoed. So to our listener's question, to look smart with your clients and your associates, well, grab a few key facts, a few statistics, for that matter, from Assemblage or other sources that are going to be intriguing, that are going to be interesting to people. In fact, from Ipsos, you can access plenty of data completely free of charge that you can quote in your conversations. You mentioned recycling. That's a good example. You can go on Ipsos.com. Oh, and by the way, not only am I not selling anything here, but you will not even have to enter your email address to access this data. You can download a full recent report on ESG, so on governance and sustainability, and you can extract some stats from this report and mention this in passing in the conversation. It always works. It's fresh insights. It's recent data from April, May, June, July. So very, very recent data. And that's what I would do. I would harness the data that you can access for free, that is easily accessible, and that you can digest very easily. Beyond market research, many of the large branding agencies, advertising agencies, strategy agencies, they publish data, they publish white papers, reports of all sorts, webinars that I encourage you to skim through, to attend, because I'm going to be very direct. It makes you look smarter with fresh knowledge that is going to validate, to confirm your intuition, and is going to give you what I think you need as an independent designer or a small studio, that what I call a stamp of approval. Because when you quote research that you did, you know, candidly, it is a nice to have. Now, when you quote Ipsos or a large agency or a large a well-known university, it gives you this stamp of approval. People trust a big brand. So that's the first tip, trick, if you will, for our audience, is access this data, skim through, extract what you need, quote this in a conversation to your client, and by doing so, lean on the strength, the reputation of the brand.
Fantastic advice. And I never really even thought about utilizing someone else's data to support my own brand strategy, but it makes total sense. Why try to go out and perform our own interviews or, you know, focus groups, if you will, as very small studios? We just don't have the structure and the time to do that. And leverage what is freely available to us. So I'll definitely get some links from you for the episode description that our listeners can go and check out. So thanks for sharing that with us.
Yeah, I think it's daunting. It's expensive. It's lengthy to do this work you described, focus groups, quantitative surveys, and all that. Don't get me wrong. I've been doing this for 20 years. I love it. I'm just saying, let's be honest. It's number one, it's hard to scale it down. Mm-hmm. Number two, it takes a lot of time and bandwidth. But think about, begin with the end in mind, meaning what are you trying to achieve? Because if you run your own research, you, in all likelihood, you will not get the level of credibility and sample size and robustness and the depth of analytics that a big agency is going to provide you with, and it's going to get very expensive. There is so much you can do from existing data, from existing reports that, quite frankly, not that many people read, that's going to intrigue and delight your clients. It's not so much about showing off with big numbers and big analytics, in my experience.
That is very heartening to hear, and it's definitely going to be something that I'm going to be baking into my process. I feel like you answered another listener question in your previous answer. Kate Hendry is particularly curious about cost-effective programs that you would recommend to get started, as the well-knowns can be a bit pricey. I mean, Kate, Emmanuel is recommending just to leverage existing data. Is there anything else that you would recommend to someone in the boutique brand strategy and design space, typically serving very small companies, to approach conducting market research for the first time beyond leveraging free data?
Yeah. Well, I don't think you want to go too deep, meaning market research, what we call advanced analytics, it gets pretty complex. And that's where you have people with PhDs all over and 15 plus years experience. And again, as a small studio, I really don't think you need this. That's not your unique selling point. Your unique selling point is your vision, is the client intimacy, how well you know your client, your market, your client's audience. That's your sell right here. It's not to try to impress with conjoint analytics and multi-touch attribution and regression models and random forests, and we can go on and on. So as such, you, while you have, depending on how, the extent to which you want to advance your knowledge, you can find some free tutorials on YouTube, or next level, you can decide to take an online course, whether it's with Coursera or LinkedIn Learnings or what have you. You can also take a 10-12 weeks course with a university, whether it's online or in person. And that's going to be a little bit more expensive, you know, probably $800, $1,000, $1,200, depending on the university. And of course, last but not least, you can decide to take a full degree in market research, which is obviously a much bigger endeavor. But again, I will start small. I will start with an online course, something self-paced that you can listen to from the likes of LinkedIn Learning, for example, to give you the foundations. The other thing is, make no mistake, so I teach at UCLA, which is obviously such a great university and a big name. And with that said, with all due respect for the institution, and boy, I love UCLA, but keep in mind that the foundational knowledge is the same, whether you, a definition of a focus group, for example, or the definition of market research is the same or should be the same, whether you learn from UCLA, University of Phoenix, Harvard, or a one-on-one coaching session with a 25 plus years market research leader who's going to charge you $800 an hour. So to acquire the foundational knowledge, you don't necessarily need to prioritize the brand. You need to prioritize the content. It is when you're going to need, again, this stamp of approval, this credibility, the robust research, that you're going to want to leverage the brand. What I call the brand, it could be UCLA, it could be Ipsos, it could be another agency or another university, but the brand brings you credibility and a stamp of approval. You don't always need the brand to acquire the knowledge.
I love that, because particularly lots of our audience members ask all the time, do I need to go to design school? Do I need to receive a degree in this in order to be a successful studio owner? And our answer is always, if you want to, go. But if not, it's not going to hold you back. I have a degree in journalism, and I took a couple of design classes. And of course, that helped me in my editorial design journey and then going over to the studio world. But there's so many options out there for learning. I mean, podcasts is a great one. I'm sure there are lots of information that people can absorb in the market research space from the podcast world as well. So thanks for sharing those.
And again, I really think your sell as a small studio or an independent designer is, think about all the things. Don't obsess about what big agencies can do and you can't. You know, of course, Publicis has offices in 97 countries and dozens of thousands of employees. And if you come to Ipsos, you'll find dozens of PhDs and people doing advanced analytics. That's not your play. That doesn't matter. What matters, what you can do, and it's very hard for an agency to replicate, is the empathy, the individual interaction with your client, the one-on-one interaction, this true understanding of the market, of the audience, of the culture, of the local culture, your ability to be attuned to pop culture, what's going on social media, what's going on in movies, in content creation. All those things matter in all likelihood a lot more to your clients than trying to impress with 120 years of collective market research experience in a boardroom. I think that's where you need to play. And you were asking also, Jen, well, how can we do conduct market research when we're a small studio? And I suggested those research resources, Ipsos.com being one. You can absolutely also do your own qualitative research. And this research is what we call anecdotal in nature. It is not scalable. But again, that's completely fine because what you're looking for are some new ideas and some initial feedback on ideas you produce for your clients and a validation of those ideas. It doesn't matter if you didn't talk to the entire country. That's not the goal. What matters is to be creative and to, again, be attuned to the audience. Conversely, the reason why big brands fail often, even though they have a lot of money and big teams, is because they lack this understanding of culture, of the audience, and they lack the empathy, understanding, and not empathizing with the audience.
I am feeling so energized and happy about what you just said, because so often we think of our own studios as independent brand designers as, oh, we're lesser than an agency, or like we can't perform the type of research that they can, or we can't get the type of results that they can. But I've, you know, your answer is so encouraging because, you know, like I was saying, oh, I'm very intuitive, or we approach solutions based off of really intense connection one-on-one with our clients. I mean, I've learned that that's a selling point. And, you know, people who choose boutique studios over agencies who are in that, you know, bracket of investment where they would be considering one or the other, typically go with smaller studios because of that personal touch, because they get to interface with the creative director on every single call. And that's a superpower of ours. So very, very encouraging.
And there are two more things we can add, and they're obvious, but they're worth mentioning, I think, at least from my perspective. Well, your clients know this. They know that you're not Ipsos. They know that you're not Publicis. They know that you're not Dentsu. Or else they wouldn't engage in that conversation with you in the first place. So it's okay, because that's not necessarily what they are looking for. Also, they might not need that scale, meaning you take advantage of an agency holding when you need a full funnel approach, one-stop shop, media planning, diversity of skill set, global expansion, and all that. It makes complete sense if you're Nike to go to a large agency because you're going to manage hundreds and millions of dollars in media buying. That's not needed when you're a more local brand, for lack of a better expression, and you're looking for some new ideas to energize your brand and your line of products. And last but not least, you know, it's not cheap to engage with a large agency. And as we said, it doesn't really scale down. And in all likelihood, I'm being a little bit presumptuous, but I'm confident in this assumption that most of your clients couldn't afford the big agencies anyway.
100%.
Right? Because if you're in sports apparel and you want to benchmark New Balance versus Nike versus Adidas, or if you're in tech and you want to benchmark Apple versus Amazon versus Google, or if you're in consumer electronics, or if you're in CPG, we can go, or if you're in alcoholic beverages and you want to benchmark craft beer versus Coors Light, Miller Lite, and Modelo, for example, I can do all this for you. Your starting point is $250,000.
Right. Yeah. And like you said, our clients, I mean, I work with independent interior designers who are typically one woman shows who, you know, are balancing family life. They're not working full time, but they, you know, they want to position themselves in their market. And you talk about perceived value and assemblage. And that's something that we talk about all the time in the brand design and brand strategy space. They just want to elevate that. And the visuals are a really important part of that. And oftentimes they will approach independent design studios like ours because the look that they're looking for. They see that in our portfolios. And so they're not coming to us for like, hey, I have this conversion problem on my e-commerce site. I mean, maybe some of the more Shopify e-commerce specific studios are attracting those types of, hey, I want to elevate my, you know, my bounce rate, or, you know, all of those terms that I feel like a lot of us just don't really use every day. And so if anyone out there is listening, I feel like Emmanuel is just giving us all a big permission slip to find what works for us and our clients, but not sweat the fact that we don't have the type of structure, support, diversification of skill sets, like you said, in the agency world, because our clients, neither can they afford that, or do they need that, or would it be impactful for them? What's most impactful for them could be, you know, anecdotal research, but oftentimes it is just our world knowledge, our life experience, our aesthetic, our taste. And that's very encouraging to hear.
Realize also that your clients are facing this exact same, I wouldn't even call it a challenge, but this exact same dynamic in their business. My point is, you just mentioned you're working with an interior designer. If I, as a customer, go to an interior designer, think about it. If I want some furniture for my house, I want some functional furniture, I can get an IKEA shelf like the one that's behind me for like $400. Or I could get a more refined, sophisticated piece of furniture. I'll go to Restoration Hardware. Now, if I want a personalized service to understand, for example, how I should paint my room, considering the light and at what time of the day I'm going to work or live in that room, that's when I want to get an interior designer involved. The point I'm making is, your interior designer client is not competing with IKEA in any way, shape, or form. It's a different service. It's a different value proposition. If I want to get a bookshelf that is easy to assemble, that is cheap, and it's going to look good enough as a backdrop, I go to IKEA. If I want to create a home that feels very personal and very cozy and that aligns very, very well with my personality, what I described as the personal identity project in the book, I go to an interior designer. It's a different type of service, and it's a different empathy interaction with the vendor. So what applies to your interior designer client, this exact same reasoning applies to your unique value propositions as independent designers or small studios. That's how I would describe your field.
Yes. Fantastic. Let's switch gears for a second to talk a little bit more about artificial intelligence. So you mentioned AI often throughout all the different chapters in Assemblage. Particularly in chapter 6, you mentioned that brands like Nike are acquiring new firms. They're turning to AI to learn more about their customer bases. I believe social listening, you mentioned in a bit of a later chapter, which is a new term to me, very interesting. One of our listeners, Katie Hedge, is curious about whether market research firms are incorporating AI and ChatGPT into their processes. And in a quick glance at the Ipsos.com website, the top three articles are all AI related. So my question for you is, how can independent brand studios like ours leverage AI to help us gain insights about our markets and our clients' markets as well, with the understanding of our previous conversations being that those things might not be the biggest selling point, but can still be impactful and help position ourselves as experts in our fields?
Yeah, AI is the ultimate buzzword, and we all need to cool down a little bit on AI.
I love it.
Couple of thoughts. First, good news again. As an independent studio, you have access to pretty almost the same tools as Ipsos does. And what I mean by this is, of course, we have walled garden versions of the tool and customized versions of the tool. And of course, we have more data to feed the model. So in that regard, we don't use the exact same version of ChatGPT you do. And with that said, there are plenty of AI tools that are available to our listeners today. Don't want to mention them just because I you know, I don't necessarily want to advertise specific tools, but I use a tool myself to summarize content, for example, to create punchlines. This tool is not expensive. I think it's $20 or $30 a month. And this capability is available to me as an individual, as it is available to a giant enterprise like Publicis or Dentsu. How can you leverage AI to do exactly this, to summarize content, to create punchlines, to optimize SEO? How can you learn? By taking tutorials, or many of those firms, they will guide you through how to use the tools. It's really not that complicated. Now, AI is doing what you tell it to do, which is the good news. I don't think AI is going to steal creativity. Again, AI works from data that you fed it with in the first place. It combines and assembles data sets to create something that seems new, but AI doesn't have the empathy. AI doesn't understand culture. AI doesn't understand emotions. All this, I keep hammering those points, but I think are really your unique selling points as independent designers or small studios. So that's how you can leverage AI. That's how you should not be too scared of AI. AI, however, will automate tasks that are repetitive. That's a very elegant way to say that if you're in the business of doing data entry, or if you copy and paste content from a Word doc to a slide deck, that task is going away. You will no longer be able to charge, or you will no longer be able to charge as much as you do today for those tasks. If anything, it's going to elevate the game towards more creativity, smarter ideas. And I think it's the more technology and the more tools we have, the more disconnected we are, the more lonely we feel. And therefore, there is an even greater market opportunity for people able to communicate with empathy, to understand emotions, and to understand culture. In my first book, I had that line that was, the more connected we are, the lonelier we feel. So we see that millennials and Gen Z, for example, while they have tons of devices and followers and likes and all that, sadly don't have many close friends to talk to. Your ability, your unique selling point as a studio, of course you can leverage AI and you should, but don't fear, it's not going to take away, not only it's not going to take away the quality, the uniqueness, the depth of this relationship, but in fact, I would argue, and let's reconvene in 2 to 3 years, that it will further showcase the value, further shed light on the value you bring to your clients. And the last thing I will say on AI, Jen, if I may be a little bit edgy, we've known each other for 32 minutes, but AI is like teenage sex. Everyone talks about it and nobody does anything. So I love it. So you read all those papers, and which they're good. By the way, there is a excellent WTF report that just came out from Ipsos on the future of AI, which again is free. So by all means, you should download it. You don't even have to give your email address. But that's all to say that at this stage, everyone's watching. Everyone is trying to figure this whole thing out. And frankly, we're all in the same boat. Here again, don't feel intimidated because you're in an independent studio and you read in the news yesterday that Publicis was going to hire or to invest billions of dollars into AI. We're all trying to figure this thing out at this stage. In fact, by the way, I should commend Publicis on being a very early adopter. They had invested in AI through Marcel a few years ago. So by all means, they're ahead of the pack. But in any case, we're all trying to figure AI out. It doesn't matter if you're 20 years veteran at a large agency or if you're in an independent studio.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of the metaverse. You know, there was a buzz around it, and you know, we saw the ads with the farmer and the students, yeah. And then you know, it's just kind of fizzling right now. And maybe you know, something for the future. But you know, I think that there's a lot to be said around, you know, what the media says about these types of things. And I was doing a little bit of my own market research from joining a private Facebook group for interior designers, kind of snuck in there just to see what people were talking about and what they were scared of or excited about within their industry. And there was this whole thread about how Wayfair has introduced a new AI tool where consumers can upload photos of their living room and have Wayfair redesign it with shoppable products. And I gave it a try and it did not look great, I have to say. I mean, no hate to Wayfair, but I feel like, yeah, I use AI for my podcast descriptions, mm-hmm. you know, little captions here and there. But yeah. I've noticed that the types of content that I'm putting out, particularly in my email newsletter, which is more of like an essay, personal diary style type of content around my life as a mom and as a studio owner. And when I kind of repurpose those for Instagram, those are the ones that get the attention. Those are the ones that get shared. It's the stuff that I'm sharing from the heart that I know that ChatGPT would never be able to replicate. So I feel good about that. And all of you guys can feel good about that as well.
I couldn't agree more. Wonderful. I couldn't agree more with everything you said.
So in chapter 7 in Assemblage, the remix economy, I love your encouragement of the borrowing or even stealing of ideas. And so much of the creative space frowns on reusing and remixing other people's types of content. There was a rapper that you mentioned that it was in the first chapter. I don't remember what his name was, who doesn't know how to read music.
It's and Kyle he just Williams. Kind of.
Oh, Pharrell Williams. Yeah, there you go. And he just kind of, he's an assembler of people. Mm-hmm. And there were some other great examples in chapter 7. But my question for you is, how can we as brand designers navigate what feels like a really crowded space of designs and ideas and Pinterest? And you even in the last, in the conclusion, talk about, hey, find ideas outside of the internet if you can, which mm-hmm. I love. How can we navigate that space and use and get inspired by others' designs in an ethical way?
Yeah. Well, in all fields, so the chapter you are referring to, Copy, Transform, Combine, is to say that I'm sure many of our listeners suffer from an imposter syndrome and are worried about plagiarism and stealing and all those things. Those yes. are can be valid concerns, but it's overblown. In most fields, we create by remixing existing knowledge. Star Wars, for example, is not as original as it seems. Star Wars was inspired from a book that was published a few years prior. Apple, we all worship, in the branding and marketing industry, we all love Apple, and by all means, it's a great brand. Apple did not invent the MP3 player. Apple did not invent the mouse. The mouse was invented by IBM. Apple did not invent the recycling bin, which I believe was a HP invention. We can go on and on. In music, Pharrell Williams is I believe, 12 times Grammy Award winner, sold millions, dozens of millions of records. And under oath, on the record, Pharrell Williams, as part of a lawsuit versus the Marvin Gaye estate, Pharrell Williams had to admit under oath that he does not know how to read music. DJs that many of us like, if you pay attention or if you like electronic dance music, whether it is, Calvin Harris or David Guetta or Plug One, a DJ by definition assembles sounds from other artists. And your question was, how can we stand out in that crowded field of Pinterest and all that? Yeah, everyone has access to Pinterest. I do have a Pinterest account. And everyone can wake up this morning and think, wow, pink is trending because of the Paul Smith wall a few years ago and now because of a Barbie movie. Mm-hmm. So if you're trying to compete on pink, that's going to be a little bit difficult for you to cut through the clutter. What's going to be insightful, what's going to be valuable to your audience is what spin you can put on pink. How can you adapt pink to new products, or what shade of pink you can use to communicate a specific feeling or a specific emotion about the brand, and how you will use pink as an inspiration as opposed to trying to make everything pink around you, which anybody can do that, including this AI service from Wayfarer that you described before. So the point is to be curious, to look at influences, of course, on Pinterest, but also in the arts, in music, in cooking, in writing. And by doing so, combine something that is new and, again, that is quirky and that is intriguing. Obviously, I endeavor to practice what I preach, whereby I bring the likes of DJ Khaled and Pharrell Williams and Jeff Koons and Picasso to a book on marketing. There is a paragraph that's called What Picasso Knew and All Marketers Need to Learn.
I love that paragraph. That was amazing.
So we can look at how Picasso built his personal brand and a wide range of products, which made him very successful. He started very poor, but he died very rich, and beyond money, made him very visible, very successful as an artist. And we can translate that concept to marketing. So once again, I think that's what's valuable to your client, something that is intriguing, something that is repurposed, something that is different. What is not valuable to your client is to copy and paste the Barbie shade of pink, whatever the Pantone color is, and to blast it everywhere in everything you do.
Fantastic answer. I tend to get sucked into the Pinterest wheel where I feel like there's just the same things coming up over and over and over again. And so I love your advice to diversify the places where you're sourcing your inspiration. And we've got several episodes about finding creative inspiration, and we talk about that all the time. And so I've definitely been leaning more into physical books about design to help inspire me. Counterprint.co.uk is a fantastic bookseller. And so if anyone out there is wanting to just turn to something more physical to inspire them, inspire their work, then I am sorry that I'm telling you guys about Counterprint, because you're going to want to spend all your money on them. But fantastic advice to kind of not be afraid to remix others' ideas, but to take everything we've talked about before, our own history, our perspective, what makes us tick, what makes us special, and infuse that into that remix, which is what is going to be valuable to our clients.
And Jen, you said, when I go on Pinterest, I feel it is the same content that's I'm exposed to over and over again. Well, you don't feel it is the same thing. And that's because of the algorithm. We have this saying in the industry that is, the best place to hide a dead body is page 2 of Google, right? And reason why in the conclusion of the book, I encourage people to stop Googling things. Don't get me wrong. Google is, or Pinterest for that matter, those are fantastic tools. There's no doubt about it. However, it gives you this false instant satisfaction, gratification that you discovered something, and chances are that you didn't discover anything, or else it wouldn't come up in the first page. To your point, by the way, thank you for pointing our listeners to this website. It's more intriguing and so valuable to open your thinking and your inspiration to other things. Also, it's good to stay current and to know what's going on this week and We can talk about the Barbie movie, that's great. And it's as valuable to bring things from the past and understand how they can influence what you do today and in the future. I'm going back to my electronics dance music example, whereby the most successful songs today are sampled from hits from the 90s or in design for our listeners today that can see the video. There is on my desk that Juicy Salif juicer that's been designed by Philip Stark for Alessi, at least 30 years ago. By the way, it's completely useless because you cannot use it to juice your lemon or else it will damage the juicer. It's also outrageously expensive because that thing retails for $150. So I spend $150 on a juicer that I cannot use to juice lemons. That is not the point. The point is, what can we learn from this design? And what is it an evergreen? Meaning, why is it as relevant today as it was 30 years ago? And maybe we can see this matte finish to it. And maybe we can see this harmonious rounded shape, which we know in design, rounded shapes are more joyful to people because they communicate a sense of comfort and reassurance, right? What are all the things that we can learn from this subject? And ultimately, maybe you might be able to leverage that kind of rocket type of design for a direct mail campaign in terms of a design element, in terms of a brand asset.
Fantastic example. And I feel like there are so many examples of the old becoming the new. It's particularly in music, you know, the 80s beats with the douche, like type, you know, like it. Yeah. I love that type of stuff, but you're right. It's not new. And I believe there was a lawsuit with who wrote Levitating? If you want to run away with me.
Dua Lipa. I don't know if she wrote it, but she's the one singing the song. Yeah.
She's the artist behind that one. And I'm not sure if there was a lawsuit or if they settled or what happened, but there was another artist that had that same like engine underneath her song. And it's the same. There's no way that she invented that, you know? And so it happens out in the world. And obviously we don't just take a logo and slap it on someone else's brand. But like, I feel like there's a little bit more just freedom in this conversation around like, okay, I don't have to feel so worried that I made a mood board and got inspiration. Like I feel sometimes like I can't even show parts of my process because I'm worried that either, you know, someone who contributed something to a mood board, I'm not claiming it as my own work, but might feel mad that I used their work as a inspiration for my work. You know, it's like we're all afraid of that, but I feel like this just gives me a little more boldness to expose more of the process and that's the first part of the process. As we go make a Pinterest board, we grab inspiration, we look through my camera roll and my phone, and you know, that's not something to be ashamed of, that's something to celebrate and to show potential clientele, hey, look at what goes into the process. It's not my brain to the Illustrator document. There is this assemblage, this collection of ideas to create something that's ultimately new, which is really exciting.
And that's your skill. That's what people buy from you. They don't need you to Google the Pantone pink for Barbie. I can do this even while we're having this conversation. I don't even need to wait for the end of that podcast. What people buy from you is your ability to create ideas, to assemble them, and translate this into a new vision that feels personal and unique to them.
Yes, that's exactly what we do. Fantastic. In chapter 9, you wrote about brands needing to shift from product market fit to solution need fit. And I paused the audiobook and I wrote that down because product market fit is just a term that I hear pretty often, something that I share with my own mentees, and I've never heard solution need fit, but that is truly what we're doing during our sales process. We're asking them what their problems are, and we're either presenting or even crafting a custom solution to help further their needs as clientele. So one of our listeners, Catherine Watson, wants to know, how can I get my clients to think beyond the obvious with the problems that they solve, how they want to be perceived, and who their target market is? And a follow-up question to that would be, how can brand designers help our clients understand their audience's pain points, the solutions that they need to have happen, and achieve the premiumization that you talk about in Chapter 9?
Yeah, well, I heard the word obvious. First, think also of what we call the curse of knowledge, meaning when you say think beyond the obvious, keep in mind that what is obvious to you is not necessarily obvious to your audience, because people are not graphic designers and brand strategists, or else they wouldn't come to you in the first place. That really something that feels, I mean, that should be a priority, just like addressing the imposter syndrome. You know more than you realize. You are more knowledgeable and more attuned to culture than you realize. You just don't realize it anymore because you do this every day. In terms of the fit to the market, again, it's going to be about understanding, immersing in the audience. Too many companies, too many brands are bubbled in their own world and spend too much time in boardrooms and not enough time with consumers. And conversely, Procter & Gamble, for example, is famous for doing a lot of ethnographic research, understanding how people use their products in their homes. So creating a product that is people first is taking a step back from, you cannot worry endlessly about market space and competition and who is doing what and all that. In contrast, you want to prioritize the audience. Keep in mind that most people don't care about most brands. Keep in mind that people don't wake up in the morning thinking, ooh, what brand am I going to buy today? Even in categories that are highly engaging, like personal care. Instead, take a step back, try to understand what are people trying to achieve. And from there, you're going to build a product and a brand that is going to help them become who they want to become. So that's what I described as the identity project in the book. The brand is not the hero. The individual, people, not even consumers, people are the hero. The brand is here to facilitate this transformation from who I am to who I want to become. And the brand is in this supporting role. And the brand may be your product, what you're trying to promote. It can make me feel like I'm successful, or it can make me feel like I'm part of a specific group, a specific crowd. It can make me feel like I'm smarter because now I have new ideas and I'm more educated. It can make me feel like it reveals my real beauty. That's what Dove does, for example. It's important to understand what are the meaningful projects, personal projects, people endeavor to fulfill, and then create products that help fulfill this desire, this want, this need that they have. Because in all categories, in almost all categories, you're not going to come up with a unique product and a unique brand anyway. And in many categories, the product in and of itself is not going to differentiate enough to beat competition. The more functional the product, the more replaceable it is. It's, you know, have at it to tell me the difference between Miller Lite, Coors Light, and Bud Light. Have at it to tell me the difference between Clorox bleach versus Target's Up and Up. Okay? The point is, how is the product going to make me feel? Well, Clorox, in its advertisement, is showing me that it's going to help me take care of my family, take care of the elderly. Oh, and by the way, they use Clorox at the hospital to keep patients safe. Well, now that is a brand I want to associate with. There is no way I could distinguish their bleach versus competition. However, it is make me it the brand makes me feel like I'm the hero here. So I'm sorry this was a long answer to a short question, but again, go for empathy, culture, being attuned to the audience. And this is often, not always, but often very hard for large brands and large agencies to replicate. That is something you can do as a small studio or an independent contractor. That is very hard for an agency to replicate. If I may, another analogy, Jen, is think about fitness, personal training versus classes versus content online. You can do push-up for free in your bedroom, or you can download an app for $10 a month that is going to show you whatever program, or you can go to a health club for anything from, what, $35 to $350 a month, or you can hire a personal trainer. And at the end of the day, push-ups are push-ups. It is a matter of on what level do you decide to engage and what level of empathy and personalization you expect. That's what you can do as an independent studio, your personal trainer to your clients, in contrast with Planet Fitness or content that you can find on Instagram for free.
I think the theme of this whole episode is that the human connection wins. And that is something that we as independent studios are able to present to our clients in terms of value. It's just very encouraging to hear all this because, you know, like I mentioned before, we tend to get down on ourselves for, oh, well, we're smaller. We can't do X, Y, Z. But I've been able to design really premium brands for clients. I've been able to have major impact in their lives and businesses. And I know that all of our listeners have as well. And so, Catherine, I hope that Emmanuel's answer helps you think beyond your question and encourages you to to realize the skills and the empathy that we're able to offer our clients that other larger agencies might not be able to access.
Absolutely.
Okay, I feel like we could talk about all of the questions in this interview for hours. But to wrap up our conversation, I would love for you to leave our listeners with one piece of advice when it comes to transforming either their own brand or their clients' brands through research, strategy, and design. So what would that be?
Yeah, this book is optimistic. If you listen to the book, it's available on Audible, by the way, or if you read the book, the overarching message is you can do it too. And what I mean by this is 99% of us did not go to the top 1% schools. And 99% of us did not grow up in households making more than $650,000 a year. And the assemblers, we spoke about Pharrell Williams, we spoke about DJ Khaled, we can speak about Picasso and Jeff Koons and Gordon Ramsay, we can go on and on. All these people, they copy, transform, combine, they create, they have an artistic vision more so than doing the art themselves. So my prompt is this note of optimism to say, you can do it too, and this book shows you how. And as extensively discussed in this conversation, do not focus, obsess on what you don't have, and I will say on what you think you don't have, because you have more than you realize. Think about everything you can do uniquely that other people cannot do.
Wonderful. Fantastic advice. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. How can our listeners get in contact with you, learn more about Ipsos, and purchase Assemblage, the art and science of brand transformation?
Yeah, people can connect with me on LinkedIn. Again, my name is Emmanuel Probst, Emmanuel with 2 M. The book is called Assemblage, the art and science of brand transformation. It's available at Barnes & Noble and other brick and mortar bookstores. And most importantly, it's available on Amazon as a hardcover, an ebook, and an Audible. Oh, by the way, good news. The Audible version, I am not the one reading the book. That means you can listen to the book without the accent and at 1.6 or 2x speed or whatever you like to do. And those are the two main points of contact, if you will. I will gladly address additional questions or comments. The reason why I invite you to connect with me on LinkedIn, I like to say, don't follow, explore. What I mean by this is I'm inviting you to connect, not so much to follow me. And I know technically it's the same thing, but to me it's very different. Because by connecting, we can start a relationship. It's not a top-down. I'm not your guru. You can interact with me. And also we can explore together, whereby you can benefit from the content I post several times a week. Once again, I'm not selling anything here. All this is free. And I encourage you not only to access the content, but in fact to steal from my writing to illustrate, to support your client conversations.
That was one of my favorite parts of the book where you said, hey, steal parts of assemblage. So there might be an Instagram carousel coming your guys' way, inspired by the writings of Emmanuel Probst, of course, with attribution. Thank you, Emmanuel, so much for joining us today. If you guys have questions for him, feel free to drop those on our most recent Instagram post or the posts in our free Facebook group, facebook.com/groups/betterbranddesigner. I will make sure that Emmanuel has an invite to the group and we'll tag him so you guys can ask questions in there. And just really appreciate your time today. This is such a fantastic conversation. And I'm just getting really excited to read your first book now.
Thank you so much, Jen, and our listeners. Pleasure connecting with you. And I really enjoyed our conversation. I'm grateful for the opportunity, Jen.
Wonderful. All right. Well, we'll see you guys in next week's episode. Bye, everybody. Thanks for listening. Hit subscribe so you don't miss an episode. Leave a review, join our free Facebook community, and share the pod with your designer friends so that they can join the fun. Give me a shout on Instagram at BetterPodcast if you want to submit an inbox question, and visit the pod at betterbranddesigner.com to learn more and snag discounts on my favorite resources. See you next week.